Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Least developed countries have invested around 14 times less in their post-COVID economic recovery than richer nations, who could do far more to help them balance out growing inequalities, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said on Monday. Addressing the UNCTAD 15 high-level virtual meeting on trade and development, Mr. Guterres told delegates that the world's pandemic recovery was moving in the wrong direction. With millions of jobs lost and social safety nets out of reach to many, the UN Secretary General reminded delegates that 120 million people fell into poverty last year. A further 811 million are going hungry today, he added, while decades of hard-won development progress are slipping away too. To turn this around, Mr. Guterres urged those gathered in Barbados and remotely to tackle four key challenges to sustainable and inclusive development. These included debt distress that left poorer countries crippled because they had to service foreign loans, and which the UN chief suggested could be fixed by creating greater liquidity and extending their debt relief payments. Bold investments are also needed in education, social protection, healthcare and decent work at the community level, Mr. Guterres said, as are fair trade rules and modernizing investment to help the poorest nations reduce costs that made them uncompetitive. The final challenge for developing countries will be to ensure their green transition away from carbon-heavy economies to green energy sources, the Secretary General continued. War crimes and crimes against humanity have likely been committed in Libya by all parties to the conflict since 2016, including external actors, a Human Rights Council-appointed probe said on Monday. From arbitrary detention to torture, the recruitment of child soldiers and mass killings, the independent fact-finding mission on Libya listed numerous grave rights violations which had impacted on the country's people. Civilians were particularly at risk during the 2019 to 2020 fight for Tripoli, the mission said, as well as during other armed confrontations in the country since 2016. The investigators published their findings after interviewing more than 150 individuals alongside parallel research in Libya, Tunisia and Italy. Here's the mission's Tracy Robinson speaking to journalists in Geneva.
Arbitrary detention in secret prisons and unbearable conditions of detention are widely used by the state and militias against anyone perceived to be a threat to their interests or views. Violence in Libyan prisons is committed on such a scale and with such a level of organization that it may also potentially amount to crimes against humanity.
Mission member Chiloki Biyani also pointed to the continued presence of foreign fighters in the country from the Syrian conflict, allegedly contracted by the Russian-based Wagner Group. The deaths of youngsters and adults in Yemen over the weekend has been condemned by the UN Children's Fund UNICEF. This follows reported missile strikes in central Marib city on Sunday, which left two children dead and 24 people injured. A day earlier, in the southern city of Aden, four non-combatants died, including one child. In a statement, Ted Shaban, UNICEF Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa, said that since fighting escalated in 2015, nearly 10,000 children have been confirmed killed or injured. The development follows a reported uptick in conflict and violent riots sparked by economic collapse and poor public services. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
You ever get the feeling that it's a goddamn jungle out there? Well, we got John Grant today. John Grant.
I'm here in the jungles of southeast Pennsylvania.
God. Man, if people knew what the military industrial complex does, and sending all these missiles and bombs all over the place, and then Do you think they're figuring out when the country is awash in guns, you know, 330 million people and probably maybe 600 million guns. I mean, and then the missile manufacturers, what is it?
Well, it's a runaway train. It's like a habit. It's just, you know, we've been said the defense industry to support, what, 700 to 1,000 foreign bases and et cetera, et cetera. We don't know what else to do. It's like hitting yourself in a rubber hammer, and you don't want to stop, you know. It's like, what do you do? I mean, we've done this for so long, we don't know what else to do. And of course, capitalism and free private enterprise and technological advances all play into the weapons industry. And, you know, they have, there must be 200 manufacturers now of AR-15s, and they're all, you know, making bells and whistles to attach to them that people have to have. And, It's a crazy country. I don't know. It's a crazy country.
Yeah. Yeah, and you say, hey, this isn't right, man. These arms manufacturers shipping guns and missiles and bombs off to other countries, we shouldn't give them licenses. They shouldn't be able to do that. And they say, well, if we don't, the Russians will do it. Well, it's, you know, they'll,
right.
It's like we've got to do it because everybody else is, you know, it's really sick.
Veterans for Peace, we've been struggling with this for, you know, the whole time since 1985. You know, it's like, 35, 40 years. And it hasn't changed. You know, we've lost Afghanistan as a war, but that won't seem to affect that. But of course, wars have changed. That's why we're out of Afghanistan. Wars have changed so much that with the internet and all, that they've become cyber wars, and that sort of juggles down, filters down with all the bytes and information, and to basically a civil war in the United States where all these AR-15s exist. You know, and so, you know, war has sort of atomized itself, so it's a different animal than it was when we went into Afghanistan. At least that's my thesis. You know, I don't know. Maybe I should develop it more. But
Pretty deep, man.
Well, I think there has to be something to that. You know, we're in a cyber war right now. I mean, crazy.
That's a Lebowski moment. I'm telling you, man.
Yeah, this aggression will not stand. remember, he's buying his half and half at the Wally's grocery store or whatever it is, and he shoots in the picture of Bush Sr. This aggression will not stand. And of course, Lebowski quotes that several times in the movie. as he's being thrown into a car. There's a beverage here, you know. Anyway.
It's just a mess, man. And I can't help it. Maybe a lot of people are at this point in the middle of this plague.
Right.
Many people say, well, it's not really a plague, although we broke 700 or 600.
Well, that's a semantic issue, and, you know, what word do you like, pandemic, plague?
I mean, how many?
Yeah.
I mean, how many are dead? I mean, how many dead did it take? I mean,
exactly.
I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the difference between pandemic and plague is the difference between depression and melancholy. You know, it's like plague and melancholy are old literary type words, you know, from the old analog days of the past. Pandemic and depression, you know, we're getting into modern thought here, you know. There's no romanticism. There's romanticism in melancholy, and, you know, there's romanticism in plague. You know, there used to, you know,
bubonic.
Well, what is the disease that was consumption? It was called consumption.
Yeah, that's another thing.
What is that? I'm trying to think of what that disease was.
The
Tuberculosis, there it is, of course, yeah. But tuberculosis, they attributed a lot of romanticism to consumption. Oh, I'm going into consumption, you know. That's how people thought. But now we're all clinical and it's pandemic and, Of course, the plague years was the Dark Ages, and, of course, some argue that we're sort of heading back into the Dark Ages, you know, a retro turn here.
Right.
Anyway,
well, that brings us to the New York Times and the lead story.
Ah, there we go.
I mean, you know, we've got to go to that because it's, I mean, you're the only person in Kansas who
Well, there's a nice on page 8. There's a nice report on the Pandora Papers. He calls it a leak money bomb with uncertain fallout, and of course has a picture of King Abdullah of Jordan. And the whole thing about it was a huge dump of information where, rich people shelter their money and hide their money and whatnot. And of course, the story of Vladimir Putin's girlfriend who bought a very expensive property in Monaco. I guess that was supposedly done in secret, but, somehow got out in the Pandora Papers here. Which is a much bigger dump, apparently, than the Panama Papers. It was done by, a collection of international consortium of investigative journalists. Includes the Washington Post and the Guardian. So all of these papers, like 600, I think they was 600 journalists throughout the world helped to accumulate all this dump of finding out where rich people are hiding their money, which is a very important effort. It said the report was published against the backdrop of an ever-sharpening rich-poor divide in the world made worse by the pandemic, which has heightened emotional resentments about wealthy privilege in many countries. And I think those emotional resentments are definitely bubbling up and brewing in not only our culture but around the world. So there's so much corruption, there's so much wealth that's going to the top and to the corrupt elements. This is the thrust, of course, of the private public gangster, if you will, quote, gangster government of places like Russia. And where does all this money go? There's so much secrecy, and that, people are starting to lift the lid on this to see what's going on. So this is a perennial search to find out where the rich are hiding their money.
And for our listeners, it's a John Grant movie type. I could give you a movie, listeners. It's available. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just check it out. It's called The Laundromat. Meryl Streep starred in it, and James Cromwell, very famously portrayed James Cromwell from I think it was Chinatown L.A. Confidential. He played
that
detective.
Paul Waspy guy. Right.
And everybody's favorite. Gary Oldman from Silence of the Lambs. There's a whole cast, an all-star cast at the Laundromat.
It's called The Laundromat. What's it about? What's the laundering money?
It's about the Panama. To be real short, it's about this old lady who gets robbed of her retirement, and she discovers it that she's been robbed in the laundromat, and she goes on this international quest with what's left of her
money. I've seen
that.
I remember I saw that, right, some years ago, yeah.
And ends up in the Panama. It's about the Panama Papers, which is similar to the Panama.
I do remember it. Good.
I'll have to check it out again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was streamed on Netflix. It's probably still available on Netflix. Mm-hmm. So. it was a great movie. I thought it was real good because it's accessible for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You can learn, have some fun, and watch a movie and learn how these, for lack of better terms, wealthy pigs rob and hide the money so they don't have to pay taxes. I mean, that's basically what it is. I mean, that's what they're doing.
Well, you know, certently Netflix is swamped with this stuff. A lot of the movies these days that are finest and made, small movies, you know, it's very important that they say based on real life, you know, at the beginning.
Right.
You know, people want that hook on it. Said, well, obviously some fictional liberties have been taken here because it's a two-hour movie. You have to. You can't. You know, reality doesn't fit into two. And as Oliver Stone said, you have to obey the DNA of drama. And, of course, you know, they cut corners and composite characters and whatnot. So what you're watching is a fiction. But it does give you a lot of information as to how, I mean, if people are savvy enough to watch these movies and realize what's going on, that this is a fictionalization. So you sort of have to look at it as filtered through the minds of writers and producers and directors and all. But reality is in there somewhere, you know, and
it's very clear. Now, listeners, I maintain, I've never said this on air, but I maintain that John Grant, now this movie, The Laundromat, the movie, The Laundromat, aired in 2019.
Right.
And that seems like a century ago, but it was just, you know, 3 years.
Right. Sure.
But I maintain John Grant, listeners, was sort of an economical Republican, a conservative at that time.
Me?
Well, this is a comedy. The Laundromat is a comedy.
No, I know. A lot of them are comedy.
Yeah, and I think I've maintained at least for the last 20 years that we should tax the living shit out of the wealthy.
Well, I don't have any problem with that, Mike. Yeah.
Well,
what?
Now I think you've changed your mind.
Slow down. What is
this? I think you've changed your mind.
Calling me a Republican.
No, I didn't say that. But I think you're fiscal conservative, maybe.
No, I have conservative traits certainly, but I believe absolutely tax the hell out of the rich. You know, I don't know where you got that I was opposed to that. You know. No, I
think you've always said that. I think I can play back a fair share, which is the common Democratic Party thing. We should tax the wealthy of their fair share. No, I think we should tax them until they squeal like pigs, you know, until they are screaming out.
Well, yeah,
I'm a crazy man. I am crazy about this, about the wealthy. I think probably because once I came close to being wealthy, a long 20, 30 years ago. It's like a spoilt lover, you know. It's like, I'll never date that bitch again. You know what I mean? You know, for you, I think you got to where you are. You're a Vietnam veteran. You've worked hard. You've got your, you've done it by being sort of conservative, you know, and I understand that, but I'm not.
Well, I see it a little differently because I was speaking yesterday did an interview with a fellow in Washington who comes from working class or left.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about
and
this.
He works with unions. His wife works with unions. And he, a left-leaning family, put it that way. When he was a week or I guess a day or so after his, within a week of his 18th birthday, he joined SNCC and went to Atlanta, right, from Boston.
Uh-huh.
And he talked it over with his parents. He said, yeah, I wanted them to know and I wanted their approval. And we would argue about it after dinner every night for a week. And finally they said, what the fuck, you're going to do it anyway, go, and we support you. Because he said it was like the military at 18. You don't need your parents' permission. At 17, you do, right? Well, I joined the United States Army in June of 1965, exactly 1 week after my 18th birthday, and basically a week after I graduated from high school in June. And then, you know, I joined the U.S. Army. I didn't need my parents' permission. So we were, I was talking with a fellow, and I realized, like, here you got, basically a little over, less than a year older than me. And here we are the same age, and we did the same goddamn thing in about 1965 or 4 or whatever it was he did. And, you know, we were 18. You know, of course, we're immortal, and we see the world needs our, we can't wait to get our help and fix it up. And, you know, here we are young and have lots of ideas and whatnot. And so I joined the Army, and he went and joined SNCC. And that put us on completely different paths, you know.
Yeah.
And then he went to work on cafes and stuff with the GI movement, and he's edited a book, Waging Peace in Vietnam, from within the GI movement, which is an important document that, you know, I'm going to write about, and you know, should be in every high school in America. You know, it's a beautiful book. But, you know, people have different paths in their life. And, of course, my family, his family was left middle class. And so they approved of him joining SNCC, but they were, you know, afraid of him getting killed, right? Because people were being killed. They, you know, killed Cheney and the two others down there in Mississippi. And so they were worried, you know. And I guess my parents would have been worried that, you know, I'd go to Vietnam and get killed. But, of course, that's what my father told us that his sons should do, you know, every 20 years.
Here we go.
And there will be a war, and you will go, you know. And so my brother and I did, and we did what we were told. And then, you know, the scales fell from my eyes, you know, over, you know, going to Vietnam and afterwards and et cetera, et cetera. It took, you know, maybe 7 years until the scales really fell from my eyes. Whereas this fella, you know, there were no scales in his eyes at all. He was against it. And so he went down to Atlanta, and then he ended up going directly to Mississippi, which, of course, was, he said, like a war zone. You know, you cross the Mississippi border, and, you know, you're in a war zone. And he was involved in, you know, the killing of these three guys. Cheney was named one. I forget the two other, Goodman, Cheney, I don't know, the three of them. And they ended up being killed and buried in an earthen dam around a reservoir, I think it was.
Right.
Well, he was down there just as those guys were disappeared, you know. And they were disappeared, and they thought arrested. And he got the job, amongst others probably, calling around all the cops, and he called the FBI, and the FBI told him, there's nothing we can do, it's not a federal issue. And finally he got to a Justice Department person that was helping him out. So they were stumbling around, and the poor kid had to keep the parents of Goodman and Cheney, et cetera, apprised that, you know, we're trying in SNCC and others, we're trying to find out where these young men are, but we can't. We don't know. Everybody says they don't know. Well, it turns out after the fact, the police let them go. And, you know, immediately or soon enough, they were picked up by the Klan, or maybe the police turned them over to the Klan. I forget how direct it was. But then they were murdered. Yeah. And so
yeah, I think it was
this guy was thrown right into that stuff at age 18, you know, living from Boston, you know. And then he tells about being arrested and being beaten up by some trustee in the jail, you know, they'd jail him and then they'd leave him in charge of these trustees, these racist trustees, and one of them took him in back and beat the shit out of him, you know, and that sort of thing. And so this is how this guy was weaned into politics, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was weaned into politics by saying I had to go to war and this was my job, and of course then Vietnam made no sense. I came home and I started reading books, and I realized, God, it does make no sense. This is outrageous, you know. So it was interesting to go through this, you know, whereas here I'm the same age as this fellow. He's done some work in El Salvador,
yeah.
So he has a real strong hard attachment to El Salvador and places like that. And so it was very interesting to go over that stuff about how, you know, the arc of people's lives and where they end
right.
up, you know, and how they
right.
think because of the arc of their lives and all this. And out of it, we both agreed that, you know, we are in sort of a difficult time, but as Obama said, a third reconstruction after the one after the Civil War that was finally backlashed into non-existence by the KKK, and then, of course, the civil rights movement in the 60s, and now where we're at in the middle of this third reconstruction of the United States of America, and in all three cases, there's a huge backlash, and so we're living through a huge backlash. And so it was really interesting to talk about that stuff yesterday.
So does your contact with this guy, I mean, did he end up
mm-hmm.
going to the Vietnam combat
mm-hmm.
theater? Or
oh, no. He has a funny story. He, again, this guy's committed. You know, this guy was real ragged, young, immortal warrior at the time when he was 18, you know. And he then segued into an interest in the, you know, their natural affinity there with the anti-war movement. And he got a draft notice of some sort. He somehow got his draft induction center established in Philadelphia here. And he tells you, I thought it was funny. I don't know whether he started out telling me it was funny, but it seemed funny to me because, you know, I'd been through
right.
basic, all that kind of stuff. So, you know,
right.
it's not the same as someone who's never been through it. Anyway, he goes to the induction center in Philadelphia, and he and this other guy, they paint themselves, right? And he's painted on his chest a big red fist, right? And it said
wow.
in the fist, in black letters, FTA, you know, which everybody in the military knows is fuck the army, right? So he's got, and here they, I said, well, what happens when they strip you down to your skivvies? And what did they say? He says, we're all lined up against the wall, right? And there's these officers, I guess he said that, you know, they were the captains and the officers who were going to look up their asshole when they had to bend over. But anyway, he said, here they're all in the skivvies against the wall. And one of these officers says to him, what's all this FTA stuff you got written on your chest?
Okay.
What does that mean? He says, what FTA was it? He says, it means fuck the army. He said it real loud. And, of course, everybody, all the guys in the skivvies and everybody broke out laughing, you know. And there was another guy, he had something written on his arm. And there's a third guy, Saul or somebody in his name, who stood up for them because there had been also some soldiers from the Fort Dix Soldiers Liberation Front, right? They called themselves that, outside. You know, this is a concerted protest here, and so they were all outside. So the military, you know, was a little worried, what's going on here? And so they put everybody, all the inductees, in a classroom and left them there, right? And so my man and his pal decided, well, hey, what the fuck? We're all sitting in a classroom. Let's give a class, right? And so they started giving this indoctrination about, you know, what will happen to you when you go to basic in Vietnam from things that they'd heard, right? And so finally they sent this tough guy in to shut him up. And he said, if you guys don't shut up, we're going to kick the shit out of you or something. And so, you know, they eased off on it. And after that, you know, they then went and showed their FTA and all this. And so there were my man and his friend were so difficult and made it clear that they were going to join, if they were put in the military, they would be what I would call, from Edward Abbey's book title, you know, a monkey wrench gang, you know, the monkey wrench soldiers. I know a friend of mine
right.
here, Stu, in Philly, who literally joined the military to organize anti-war stuff in the military,
right.
And so this guy was going to do that. And I think with all their antics at the induction center, it became clear to the powers that be that, whoa, these guys are going to be trouble. Look what they've done here today, you know. They've got guys from Fort Dix out, 20 guys from Fort Dix out in front of the building, active duty people, you know. These guys are really going to be a problem. And so they refused him induction, and then he was never sent to the military. He got out.
Because, this was like 65, 66?
Yeah, this would have been probably 67, something like that. You know, 60,
yeah, that, I mean, that's really amazing. I know a lot of people, including myself, were, you know, I sort of came alive with my eyes in 71, 72, but it only came out because of the news, the static field filled black and white television that I learned about that stuff. And I, there was no real anti-war movement in Kansas, you know. There were a few people at the universities, and that's about it. And you just really didn't hear it. And I was stuck deeply into the working class at that time. I was just a kid, and I knew I was going to be in the working class. I knew I was going to be in the working class, and I thought this is a – and I knew I was going to get drafted. And I was like, oh, man. And there was, you know, it's just like that's the only way I learned about it. But it inspired me.
The point of this book, Waging Peace in Vietnam, the GI movement, it's a beautiful book of voices from all aspects of that. And he's now in process of getting it translated into Vietnamese, because the impetus for this book came with Ron, my friend, the guy I'm writing about, going to Vietnam and ending up in the War Remnants Museum in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, which I've been to and filmed in. And he's talking to the director of the War Remnants Museum, which has in it some very respectful images of U.S. soldiers, you know, as suffering soldiers, you know. And so he set up an exhibit for the War Remnants Museum, right, on the GI movement within the U.S. military. And then he created it into 17 panels that they took to Notre Dame University, and then they put it on panels so that they could truck it and move it around, right? And then at some point, somebody said, well, Jesus Christ, you know, I mean, this is a great exhibit. Let's make a book. And so out of that, he got his wife, who's a labor writer, involved. And he's got another, Jim Courtwright, who wrote a book called Soldiers in Revolt, which is the book on the GI movement. So those three edited this book together. And as I say, it's a very attractive, very important book that should be, in my view, in every high school in America. And the point being that this movement has been crushed. I mean, the idea of it has been crushed. You know, the information, the news of it has been crushed. The story of it has been crushed. Again, people don't think about it, but it is one of the key reasons that the U.S. could not sustain its war in Vietnam, you know, because of this internal movement. There were people who set fires on aircraft carriers so they couldn't leave on their missions. There were mutinies. They called them mutinies on aircraft carriers. There were hundreds of off-post mimeographed irreverent newsletters and newspapers and whatnot. And Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland were going around to the various cafes, many bases, and in fact, the big bases all had off-post anti-war cafes. And so there was a really concerted movement to you know, work on the military, work on the anti-war movement from within the military. And, of course, it's to the military's advantage that this is not known, and to the patriotic Americans and all those other folks that, you know, the ones who subscribe to the stabbed in the back myth, which, of course, we're seeing now with Afghanistan, you know, the idea that, you know, how George, how, and not George, but Joe Biden stabbed us in the back by, or stabbed America's honor in the back by leaving Afghanistan the way he did. And, you know, it's predictable. This stuff is predictable. You know, nobody's at the time criticizing the son of a bitch who started the war, the stupid war. We're now criticizing the guy that, you know, imperfectly stopped it and banded it. And, you know, it's just, this is the way wars are run, you know. And so the stabbed in the back myth is always appears. It's appearing now. And it certainly appeared in the Vietnam War. And, of course, it would be, you know, this GI movement from within is certainly stabbing the heroes in the back. I mean, it's a part of that.
No.
I mean, that's the way the right would look at it.
Well, that's the popular myth. I mean, that's the
genre. It is. It's called a myth. It's very mythic.
Date ourselves. Let's date ourselves. This is like the John Wayne Western myth. This is Gunsmoke.
It's myth. Myth is a word that's often misused because myths are like...
what would you call it?
Well, a myth is not like an error. It's not the fake news or anything like that. Somebody says something's wrong. That's a myth. That's an error in fact, or a factual error, or fake news, or lies, or bullshit, or whatever it is. A myth is more larger cultural kind of historical, even spiritual kind of story, if you will, that is shared over a large number of people. It's sort of insinuated in their cultural being as a myth of what makes things tick and how, you know, the meanings we establish to ourselves in a rather large cultural sense, as I say, even involving spirituality and things like that. At least that's my understanding of myth. You know, I mean, the term is often used with the Romans and the Greeks, Olympian gods. These are all the myths of all these gods. And of course, you could argue that the myths and the traumas and the foibles of these, it's almost like soap opera gossip about their gods. But these are forms, in effect, de facto, these are cultural, societal stories that everyone shares, you know. And so in Greek theater, you have the same mythic people like Hercules and things like that, you know. And Hercules wasn't, of course, a 1950s Italian movie starring Steve Lee.
Yeah, right.
Hercules was a mythic character in Greek mythology.
Well, all the old people out here I know, they watch something called METV, M-E-T-V, and all is endless loops and loops and loops of reruns of, and there's Grit TV. It's just old westerns, John Wayne, Errol Flynn. I think you know, you may disagree with me about the use of the word of a dominant myth, but
okay.
I think the media has created, if anything, people, these iconic images that they created during the 50s and 60s and 70s into gods.
Right.
They're actual gods.
Well, I am a total subscriber to the idea of the Western myth. I mean, my God, the Western. The Western is mythic territory from the get-go, you know. I mean, there's a reality of the West in history, right? And then there's, you know, the crap, there's, you know, Randolph Scott movies in the 50s, John Wayne movies, you know, and of course you have the great movies, Clint Eastwood, The Unforgiven, which to me is a great movie, flawed great movie, because it deals with the myth of the gunfighter, you know, this idea of the gunfighter. And
yeah,
you know,
that's a little bit deeper. I would call that a contra. I would call that a
right. Well, it's in that sense, it's examining and deconstructing and taking apart that myth, if you will. You know what I mean? So that's why it's a sophisticated Western into our more modern times. You know, whereas John Wayne and The Searchers and you know, the good John Wayne movies, or John Ford directed them and whatnot. You know, they're very much a part of the Western myth. Yeah.
The only thing redemptive about those fucking movies was the broad horizon landscape shots of the New Mexico and Arizona desert.
Absolutely.
The rest of it was just a bunch of bootlegging imperialist horseshit.
Well, I mean, John Ford made every other movie he made, I think, in Monument Valley. Nevada or somewhere with all, you know.
Yeah,
he must have made all six or seven movies in that setting.
Yeah, it's a broad expanse.
It's the
broad expanse of great America to be exploited. You know, we know this. But for me, I think it's been embedded, for lack of better terms, embedded in many of these people, my parents, and my age, generations around me. I mean, I think the media has a huge power, and if it's in the force of conservative reactionary U.S. imperialism, I think it destroys much of the things like today, where I mean, how can they get away with this? Joe Biden is now a piece of shit in the national polls. Okay.
Yeah, but those polls go up and down.
Let me finish. Let me finish.
Oh, please. Yeah.
And George Bush Jr., anyone asked how much are you getting paid? He's on a national speaking tour going around Beverly Hills and places. I mean George Bush Jr., who brought us into this fucking
right. It's the resurrection of George W. Bush. Absolutely. Yeah. Attempted resurrection.
And how much is he? I mean, you know, and now these guys aren't even, shit compared to Jeff Bezos. I think this myth clouds the acumen, the ability for citizens to understand what's really going on in the country, and that's why that Pandora paper Panama papers. These tax refuges. I mean, and it does no good service to Joe Biden that he represented Delaware, which in the Pandora papers are being listed as along South Dakota as the biggest tax holes where rich people can hide.
Well, that's been Delaware as a corporate haven has been a no shit Sherlock fact for a long, long time. You know, and as I always say, you know, like, what is it about Joe Biden that he was the perennial, permanent, forever senator from Delaware, the corporate state, when he's considered like Joe Sixpack, working class Joe from Scranton, Pennsylvania? Like, wait a minute, what's wrong with this picture? This working class, you know, Joe Sixpack guy is the permanent senator from the absolute corporate state of Delaware, you know. So, you know, Joe Biden figured out something. You know, he could represent himself as a working man and represent, you know, corporations, you know, that are given, you know, they get away with tax havens in places like Delaware, you know. And of course, we now learn that South Dakota is like that. I remember my wife and I spent like 3 days in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, we went out to see a graduation of a Sudanese woman, young woman we know, and it turned out to be it's so complicated I won't even go into it. But the main absurdity was I was supposed to get an economy car, you know, my rental to drive over. And they didn't have one, so they gave me this goddamn Chrysler boat. I mean, it was like a luxury cruiser. I mean, it was a monstrous car, you know. And we my wife and I, and they charged me for the economic car, you know, so I could pay
right,
for nothing.
Right.
But the only trouble was it was like a weekend and they were closed, and one of the tires would leak. And so every day I had to go pump up the one tire, you know. And we would have to go. They had these. It got really silly because they had these minute marks, right? And they were called come and go. And so my wife and I would always have to pull the boat into the come and go to get some air, you know. And with these guys, there's some derelicts around the garbage center. They're smoking their weed as I'm putting my air in this huge monstrous boat. I mean, yeah, actually we enjoyed ourselves. It was a totally absurd visit.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, that was my only experience with South Dakota. But it kept,
but
you know, I guess
to find
it's
out.
A center for credit cards, right?
Yeah, it is an actual, it's a hub. Sioux Falls
is an
actual hub for many of your credit cards and mail processing,
right.
You know, direct
and,
mail
and,
processing.
And, you know,
the
state,
bill,
like Delaware, gives corporate entities lots of perks and breaks. That's why they go to Delaware. Well, obviously
right.
the credit
right.
cards go to South Dakota because South Dakota is giving them perks and credits and tax breaks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's a very conservative state. The governor, I forget her name, but she is a right wing celebrity. She may run for president. I don't know. You know, another Sarah Palin, and
another white woman with a gun.
Yeah,
and a horse.
That's what we need.
And a horse.
Another white woman.
With a gun, running for office. Vote for me. Well, you know. You know, I'm wondering, you know, but this is, to me, I think if all else fails in Congress, and I know the Times is, the news media is covering this,
right.
The standoff is going on with the Mitch McConnell, Trump tax standoff
right.
and the infrastructure and the, you know,
right.
and now the debt ceiling.
I know. It's like a train wreck. You know, you wonder what's going to come out of this. And well, the only optimistic thing is that Joe Biden, who, you know, may be a doddering idiot on some level, I think on another level, his age is accrued to some certain wisdom. And he, who understands Congress probably more than many, he says, look, this may not happen this week. It may not happen next week. You know, it may take 6 hours, 6 days. It may take 6 weeks, but we're going to do it. So, I mean, everybody expects an answer right now. I want it right now. And
yeah.
He says, look, just shut up, slow down. You know, look, we're going to do it. And, of course, in the end, he may fail, but in the end, he might not. You know, I would not be surprised if they – humiliate Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin enough that they jack up the $1.5 trillion that Joe Manchin says he'll go for,
right.
and they jack it up to say, wait, $2.2 trillion, right? Not the 3.5, but the 2.2. And I guess it started out as $10 trillion at first, and then it was $6
trillion. Well, you know, the joke about this is to be spent over 10 years.
I know. Well, nobody knows Yeah, nobody.
Check me on that. Check me.
Yeah, it's true.
But
I'm
serious. This is what makes me so pissed off at the corporate Democrats and the McConnell the Trump Republicans.
Right.
And there is no Republicans except Trump, if you ask me.
Right.
So, and McConnell. And this is what pisses me off. I think they're doing a gross you know, they're not telling the truth to the people in a sense. This is over 10 years, this war.
Well, I mean, that's clear.
That's not a lot of money.
If you follow the Democrats, that's clear. But, of course, this is the trouble with the media. The media does not give explanations of anything. It's always, they're so sensation oriented, you know, that
right.
that they, you know, they complain, oh, we have the 3.5 number, but what are you doing to really explain this to us? You're doing nothing, you know.
Right.
So you're guilty as charged. You're not, you know, you're complaining that, oh, everybody's just talking about the numbers, but you're not going behind the numbers,
yeah.
and you're not explaining this stuff to the point that people really understand it. So, yeah,
right.
it's, I think it's a legitimate criticism.
I mean,
absolutely.
I'm pretty sure checking on it, that these sums are large sums, no doubt about it. But
sure.
It's over a 10-year period. It's over a 10-year
absolutely.
Period.
Absolutely.
And
as I say, they first started talking about $10 trillion, so a trillion a year that
yeah.
would have been. You know?
Right, yeah. right.
So they whittled it down to
3.5. I'm worried that the economic reforms that are being proposed by the corporate Democrats and the Trump-McConnell
right.
Republican Party
right.
is a kabuki play, a shadow play
yeah. Yeah.
That,
fair
will,
enough.
That will not be yeah. it will not be enough. It's necessary to
right.
Do it, and I because of the stiff resistance, I think I don't know if she's still the head of the. Who is Janet Yellen? I asked you that.
She's the Janet Yellen is the Treasury Secretary, I think, right now. She was the head of the Federal Reserve a while ago, but
saying,
now she's, I think, the Treasury Secretary.
Well, it's these headwinds.
Right.
I'm pretty sure about my quote from her. These headwinds, that they're running up against progressives and the socialistic types like Bernie Sanders and the AOC people. You know, the progressive caucus in the House and what few are in the Senate, you know, they're running into these goddamn headwinds, and I think Joe Biden's with them, frankly. I think he supports it. It's good advice to delay another 2 weeks on this, to put the heat, you know, put a Sinema and Manchin in an Instapot, you know. Have you ever
right,
known what an Instapot
right.
is? And cook them fuckers, you know. But, you know, But I really think, and it was a smart move to, you know, keep the heat on and let's slow cook these bastards in a crock pot. You
right,
know?
Right, right.
But these headwinds are so bad. I mean,
yeah.
Yellen said if they don't raise the debt
right.
ceiling, it could be catastrophic to the world economy,
yeah.
not just goddamn the United States.
Well, you think about the world depression in the 30s. We've avoided that with money management and all this kind of the arts of economics that they've learned from the Great Depression. But here we go, this polarization of politics in America with the McConnell dumb shit attitude, they could, as Yellen suggests, they could trigger a new worldwide disastrous depression like the 30s. It's almost like the politics of the last 5 years or so, it's almost like we're kind of doomed that these people are so dysfunctional in their polarization that, you know, and the idea of, quote, bipartisanship has become a joke, you know. I mean, people use it, and it's not a serious idea anymore. And in fact, Sinema is trying to suggest that she wants to be a new John McCain. You know, she wants to be a maverick like John McCain.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah, what the fuck, you know? But the thing about Christian Sinema that really weirds me out. I mean, it really weirds me out. Today, Michelle Goldberg writing about her. It says, in 2003, Joe Lieberman, at the time, the worst Democratic senator, she says, a little opinion, traveled to Arizona to campaign for his party's presidential nomination and was regularly greeted by anti-war demonstrators. Quote, he's a shame to Democrats, said the organizer of a protest outside a Tucson hotel, a left-wing social worker named Kristen Sinema. Quote,
I don't even
know why he's running. He seems to want to get Republicans voting for him. What kind of, you know, this woman was a, she was in the Green Party. And she was a social worker, I guess, and she was with an anti-war gang. I mean, how does she end up being, the stopping block for this, liberal progressive things that they're trying to push through? Because all these things are, in my view, the 3.5 social, movement, infrastructure stuff, and the 1 million or 1 trillion popular bipartisan stuff that some Republicans want to get their name on, and all of this stuff, what that really is, and this is why the pharmaceutical companies, corporations are spending millions to thwart this thing, is in effect this big social bills that they're pushing are about money for sure, but they're about restructuring wealth in America. They're the old idea of redistributing wealth. They're shuffling it up, like to take tax
John,
the fuck
John,
out of the rich.
It's
you
not,
know,
it's, John, we're talking about literally, 28% on income or corporate taxes. These are just a few percentage points in taxes raised on people making over $400,000 a year, or on major corporations employing over 500 employees. These are minuscule amounts compared to what was happening immediately, even after World War II.
I know the 50s, it was 90% you were taxed.
Yes. And this
I understand that. Mike, I understand that. And I'm not advocating any of this. I'm just saying this is what's happening.
I'm talking to our audience. I'm not talking to the audience. I mean, this is they must understand this, and this is really important for people out in the red state areas to understand. This is saying it's over 10 years, and it's minuscule percentages. It's taxing a higher percentage on the $1 over $400,000. You're still going to get the $400,000 damn dollars, but you're going to pay a few percentages more, a few pennies extra out of that dollar over $400,000. This is like the 10-year thing. I think red state people have been so indoctrinated, and I'll be honest with you, many people.
I think you're right.
And all across the country, they miss the 10-year, and they miss the minuscule amount of increase that is being done, on the taxes. They're not taxing the $400,000 that rate. They're taxing the $1 over $400,000. And the corporations, there's so many tax loopholes for corporations.
I don't disagree with anything you're saying. So, I agree with that. But how do you get that across to people when what the right is doing is slapping a label on this as socialism? I mean, that's what they've been doing since the beginning of these campaigns. And unfortunately, for the argument, there is some merit to that. This is an effort. If you look at society as a melange of many, many isms, especially the incredibly huge and ungainly thing called the United States of America. We are a melange, a soup, if you will, of so many isms. We're that big and that confusing that there's a lot of isms at work. We have some fascism in our system, militarism, of course, capitalism, of course, and socialism, of course. And what's happening is that the corporatism and the militarism is overwhelming because of their power, the socialistic aspects of the society, and they demean it. They call it a cancer. They call it the devil, and so they want to crush it even more. Whereas what these bills are doing is saying, no, we've gone far enough on militarism, corporatism, and all that. We're not going to get rid of militarism and corporatism and all that kind of stuff, and a little fascism maybe here in the police departments now and then. But the point is, for a well-rounded society that works in the future, like we did in the 50s, we need to empower the bottom up, And the way to do that is with bills like this that will do some redistribution of power and wealth and things like that. So, I mean, if you look at it as a larger picture, that's what it's doing. But, of course, greed gets in and power gets in, and so all these pharmaceutical companies and corporations that are paying now to lobby and slam these bills, pushing cinema and people like that, you know, they're trying to kill it. So it's a struggle, and it's a struggle between, you know, capitalism and socialism.
Yeah, I know, that's the music, brother.
And of course, socialism doesn't have to be a dirty word, you know.
John Grant, I'm telling you, John.
Okay, let's get up.